So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, John Whittingdale takes a break from Brexit to address the issues that matter to the media. We talk loopholes and Leveson 2. As the BBC brings back its pop-up station Radio 2 Country, y'all, we head to Maida Vale to discuss how these temporary channels are changing the radio brand. Plus, the new day is 1 week old. We take a look at its first 5 editions. Are there early signs of success for BBC 3's move online? And the media quiz heads to Salford for a spot of natural history. That's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me this Friday at the Hospital Club, it's the Managing Director of Lemonade Money, the award-winning Faraz Osman.
Thank you, the award-winning Lemonade Money. How long do we can we keep that up for before it gets tired?
We won our Sony Award in 2010, we're still playing on it.
Milking it for all it's worth.
Yeah, and what have you been up to this week, Faraz?
We're actually looking at planning for 2016. We've got some interesting thoughts about other things that we want to do, including, I don't know if I can reveal it, but we are chatting Go about on. Some original content stuff. And whether or not we should be doing our own bits and pieces away from other broadcasters. So that's quite exciting.
Breaking out on your own.
Not breaking out on our own, but
just
ensuring that
you're the Zayn Malik of indie TV production company.
Is that racist? I feel that's racist. I'm
like, that is a classic example of you interpreting something that I said in complete innocence.
Hashtag Project Diamond.
And joining Faraz, the deputy editor of metro.co.uk, it is the digital media brain and body of Alex Hudson.
Media and body?
Yep.
How is a body digital?
Well, if you don't know that, I'm not sure you should be in post, quite frankly. What's been going on at metro.co.uk, Alex?
You've been
doing very well, according to your own masthead.
According to our own masthead? Yeah. That is the meanest thing you've ever said.
Well, no, the only source I've seen for how many shares you've been getting is you proudly boasting on your own masthead that you've got millions.
The ABC
well
stand those up, but thank you. Two things. One is we're busy planning for the next 2 years, the big serious future of metro.co.uk. And I spent the morning chasing after a man called A Man in the Shed. So we've found this man.
What do you mean?
We've found this man on Facebook who's receiving random messages from strangers, making slightly racist jokes about the fact he's called A Man in the Shed, saying, "Can you please get out of my shed?"
Well, his name is Amin Our Shed.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And we're trying to work out if it's a lie, if it's a spoof, if it's made up. We still don't know. So all of that could be entirely false. So we're trying to stand it up and work out if it's true or not.
And doing the rigorous journalistic work to find out whether Amin Arshed is a real man or not, does that tally very strongly with the serious big future of metro.co.uk?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it entirely does. Both serious stories and actually being a place where the most ridiculous things of the internet, you can find out if they're true or not.
Brave new world, or should we say new day? More of that later. The culture secretary, John Whittingdale, he says laughing, no one ever says that laughing, was at the Oxford Media Convention this week. He addressed a few hot potatoes there, including the BBC and Leveson 2. Yes, that really is a thing. Are we ever going to stop talking about Leveson? And then he dodged a few other issues, like Channel 4, before throwing in a curveball on ad blocking. But Faraz, let's start with the BBC, as is traditional here. The Guardian reported on Friday that there won't be a white paper until after the referendum. What did the Culture Secretary say in Oxford?
I think the most pertinent thing is obviously that he's closing the iPlayer loophole. I mean, it's about time that that's happened. I think a lot of people have been gaming the system, and
so this is people not paying their license fee but watching the BBC online.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's a it's just, you need to future-proof the BBC if you want to continue going down a license fee route. You have to ensure that anybody that's consuming BBC content is paying fairly for it. And I think it's sensible that we close that if we're going to continue using the license fee as a way that we're going to fund the BBC. And then there's obviously some chatter where you said it wasn't distinctive enough, and that's obviously made ITV and all those guys very happy. I guess it's always a challenge for the BBC, isn't it? They've either got one question, which is, you're not distinctive enough, you're not doing enough like niche programming about the arts, and then you've got another thing that says, well, you're not being mainstream enough, no one's watching your content. So they're in this kind of purgatory for the rest of their days, and this is just where the side of the coin is landing today. And I think it's slightly unfair. I think the BBC continue to do stuff that's on both sides of the spectrum, and as I always argue, and I kind of agree with, you have to do some populist things to ensure that it cuts through. And like I always say, I don't think anybody else can do Dragon's Den or The Apprentice or Bake Off as populist and as well as the BBC does. I think if you saw any of those shows on ITV, in fact, there was like an ITV version of Dragon's Den. Do you remember that?
Oh, Fortune with Peter Jones.
That's the one. Which was
I bloody
so
love that
awful.
Show. No, but it was so bad it was good.
I don't think that's an argument that would stand up for the BBC. Or look at our content, it's so bad that it's good. I can't imagine Whittingdale being too enamoured by that.
Actually, I may have just conflated two shows in my head. There was one which... No, okay, Tycoon with Peter Jones was the one I really enjoyed.
Whatever it is.
Fortune was the one which was just basically people begging for money. It was Dragon's Den, but instead of saying, I have an idea, it was just, I'm really poor, can you give me some money, please, Duncan Bannatyne?
So that sounds like... Yeah, it shows how memorable those shows were, that you have no idea what they're called or really what happened in either
no,
of
no,
them.
No, no, no. Tycoon was good. I promise Tycoon was good. Whittingdale, Alex, has also been talking about Leveson 2, Return of the Sith.
And everyone breathes out and groans. And it's... I don't see what more we need to discover. I think, you know, Leveson was very much... We already know most of the things that were going on in Leveson, even way before Leveson. It just took that full stop at the end of that period of journalism, happily before I ever became a journalist. The worst bits of that happened. And now you're thinking, okay, great, we know that journalism has been broken and that people have been doing questionable things on legal grounds or even on moral grounds. Okay, right, the... journalism has stepped on and jumped up and changed, and we still don't quite know how journalism works yet, but the idea that we're somehow trying to distill that into a here's everything that's wrong already seems either premature or way too late. It's just a really confusing time as to why you would start that now.
And would you say that to Hacktoff if they were in the room? You know, they don't need to keep bashing on about this, it's all been dealt with, we're all good boys now.
I don't think we're all good. I think we don't really at Metro Kodiko follow the celebrities round, and we don't push them. We find if a story is only a story if it's a celebrity doing something. So that's the differentiation that we've made. They have to be doing something for it to be worth us chasing and writing about. And the members of Hacktoff are right to feel aggrieved that they've been chased down the street for whatever reason. And if the law isn't robust enough to say, is this in the public interest? Is this fact? Is it worth pursuing? The law is already there. All of the mechanisms are in place to enforce all of these things. It's just that if they're not being followed, that's not something that Leveson 2 needs to explore. It's just something that needs working through on existing legislation.
Faraz, there was a lot of scepticism that the Tories were going to brush under the carpet after the election all of this press regulation stuff. But Whittingdale is meeting Hacktoff. Do you think there is actually a desire to try and clean things up still?
I think that I'm really curious because I work in the TV industry and I work in the broadcast industry, and we don't do journalism from a print point of view. In fact, we don't do news at Lemonade Money or any of the work that I've done previously. But I just find it so bizarre that we've had a massive inquiry where Leveson made some recommendations, and the press are able to just turn around and go, well, that was nice, and thanks for that inquiry, but we're just going to ignore you, and we're not going to take on any of the recommendations, and actually, we don't need any of that. And I think that that's frustrating from my viewpoint, when I think Ofcom, you know, it's not perfect, but actually, it's kept broadcast, and in particular, the journalism on broadcast news pretty strong and robust. And I think that we've had some really great breaking stories that have happened across broadcast news, from Sky News to Newsnight. We've had some really strong stories from there, and it's never really stopped them from breaking news stories just as well as print journalism has. And in addition to that, I really do think that if we had a situation where television was investigated in the same way that the press was investigated via the Leveson inquiry, spent all of that public money, went through all of that rigorous process, and then television turned around and said, you know what, we're cool and we can regulate ourselves and don't worry about it. I think the press would actually hang them and would say, I cannot believe that the TV or the BBC or ITV are able to get away with this. There seems to be one rule for newspapers and another rule for everybody else.
Okay, talking about the press and impartial news in the press, I have here a copy of the paper that says it's completely politically impartial, Trinity Mirror's new publication, New Day. It's been on sale for a week, and the early signs are that around 150,000 people a day are picking up the paper, although that is at the trial price of 25 pence. It's going to go up to 50p soon. On the first day, Monday, about 1.5 million people are said to have tried the free edition. I've got Thursday's copy here. Whilst everyone else was talking about Europe, their front page is a photo montage of children with meningitis and a story about the footballer Adam Johnson. And on the back, this newspaper that says it's offering something different to the internet has, can you guess, these four internet cats. But let's talk about the tone generally of the paper. Alex Hudson, what do you reckon?
I think, first of all, to call a paper without a view and then run a piece in it about Donald Trump and how it would be abhorrent for him to become president, that you're already going against your whole reason d'etre if you're coming out as this impartial newspaper. And people like hearing opinions, so the opinion pieces in it are for and against are interesting.
Yeah.
But the idea that they don't have columnists and then have Yasmin Alibaya Brown writing stuff, and they have a number of other big traditional columnists in there. And I've read through it the first few days it's launched, and I think the biggest criticism I have of it is that I have no real strong opinion about it. It exists, it's there, it's perfectly pleasant, it's well laid out, it's well thought through. Editorially, it's good-ish. It's just a thing of, it takes a while for a new paper to really develop a voice. But you have no idea what the voice is coming from that paper because it's so desperate to be impartial, however impartial it may or may not be.
Do you know what it reminds me of, actually, Faraz? Is it reminds me of when there was that battle in London for the free evening sheets before the Evening Standard went free, and we had London Light and the London Paper, if you remember those. Both of them really quite bland, obviously written by kind of young journalists starting out, and a small team, lots of photos. And they kind of pass a journey on the train, don't they? But they were free, and this is 25p.
Yeah, it did remind me a lot about the London Paper, and I actually mourned the loss of the London Paper. I really enjoyed it and felt
really?
Like it was... Yeah, just because it kind of... Almost to your point, that it was impartial. It wasn't trying to be a shouty newspaper. It was just something that you picked up on the way home, and it had regular features in it, and you kind of flipped through it, and you knew what to expect, and it wasn't something that kind of changed your opinion as such, which... You could argue for a newspaper is a bad thing, but for a little commute home, it was the right sort of size and the right sort of weight, both politically and physically, for a little commute home on London, and kind of made sense to me. I felt it was a better paper than the London Light, for sure.
And my editor, who used to run the London Light, would be vehemently arguing with you about London Light versus London Paper.
I think, you know what, I think probably from a design point of view, that's where I start from it, because I think the London Paper was much better designed and easier to read than London Light. I thought the London Light was
a mess. Let's not rehash the route from 3 years ago.
Yeah, when it comes to the New Day, there are two things that I would say about the New Day. Is firstly, it's the eye. It just looks like the eye clone. It's almost like the same tone and the same feel as what the Independent have done, and you kind of feel like it's a straight rip-off. I think there was a story about how the Mirror tried to buy the eye
yes.
and weren't successful, so this does feel like their way of getting into that space.
Yeah, but, well, friend of the show Adam Bowie has been blogging about the New Day this week, suggesting that actually the whole purpose of it is that it is a spoiler, and it's been published simply to ruin the chances of Johnson Press's version of the eye taking off. That, yeah, Mirror wanted to buy it, and then when they couldn't get it, they thought, well, let's just do a version of it. Seems to me, though, that the Eye was based on the Independent's journalism. The New Day being based on the Mirror's journalism is struggling to find quite such substantial stories to report on.
Yeah, and I think for me it's just a style and form thing. I've only had a chance to flick through it. But the key thing for me is I can't... If I'm being brutally honest, I'm not sure my opinion on the New Day is particularly valid. And the reason I say that is because I live in London. And when you live in London, you walk out any tube station and you get a copy of Stylist, or you get a copy of Sport, or you get a copy of The Enemy, and it's similar in style,
or
the Metro,
or Time Out, or Coach,
and it's
what
and
else
it's,
can we list?
And I think we are spoilt in London by this sort of journalism, this kind of like, you know,
it's a TAM. Sorry, yeah, I'll stop now.
But in particular, Sport and Stylist and Shortlist, they've all got this kind of like magazine-y feel to them, which this has as well. So as a result, a lot when I'm flicking through it, it feels like stuff that I've seen already, because it feels like that kind of supplement of a newspaper rather than a newspaper in its own right, because it's devoid of any opinion and devoid of any political leaning.
You know, now you mention that, if you take it out of the southeast and you imagine yourself, you know, in a greasy spoon in Sheffield, actually I would be more comfortable in a way reading that than reading The Sun or The Mirror.
Exactly.
I suppose from that point of view, it is kind of aimed at me.
I think there's one key point that's a very well-researched rumour doing the rounds around newsrooms is just how furious Johnston Press are about this launch, because if they'd have known it was happening, rumours suggest that the premium they paid for the Eye might not have been as high as it was.
Interesting. Okay, and final point, the quality of the paper. This feels like a bizarre thing to be talking about on a podcast that's obsessed with the digital future, but they have invested in nicer feeling paper. Was that worth it? It's a bit like The Guardian doing their Berliner thing, isn't it? I mean, it is better, but does anyone care?
Do you want to know what's better than paper? The internet. The internet is wonderful and provides you with an infinite amount of news that you would like to talk about an infinite number of things, about anything you can think about. It allows you to Google whatever you want, to search on Facebook for any page you like. At any time of the day you choose, and it updates as it goes. You will never find an outdated story that has not been already updated.
There is a dirty joke I could do here about the internet rubbing off on your fingers, but I won't.
Oh, you can't say you're not telling a joke while telling the joke. That's not...
You've got me. Right, let's move on to ITV. And despite some less than stellar ratings this year, ITV PLC has actually had a fantastic year, financially speaking. A lot of this, I think, is down to Downton Abbey. They announced a 6% rise in profits, advertising revenues also up 6%. But crucially, advertising isn't where the big gains were. In fact, the broadcaster is now less reliant on sponsors than it's ever been, and 49% of ITV's revenues now come from other sources. Faraz, when Adam Crozier became CEO, this was actually his mission statement, wasn't it? So is it mission accomplished?
Adam's, as far as I'm concerned, has been a genius in this space. He's been able to offset what's happened in the advertising downturn. He saw it coming a long way off before I would argue any other broadcaster, and he's done some really clever, smart things to ensure that the ITV remains a viable business. And I think if you look at what Channel 4 have been doing about investing into investing into indies and also Sky starting to buy people like The Garden, you've got other people that are kind of copying this model, because it's actually probably the right model where you're buying up IP and using your broadcaster as a way to launch IP, make it popular and then sell it elsewhere. And that's a smart, interesting model that's worked for ITV, and I think that a lot of credit should go to him. What I would say is that I'm curious to know how sustainable it is. From what we've seen, there are more and more international broadcasters and brands that are interested in doing full buyouts. So this IP model of selling things, something like Downton Abbey, across the world, I think if you went and did a deal with Netflix, I would expect that Netflix would take all your rights and all your secondary rights to people, and that includes people like Amazon and all these kind of new publishers. This secondary rights model may have a shelf life, and it'll be interesting to see if this model that is working for ITV today is sustainable in 5 years' time.
But if the company is becoming more resilient to the effects of the digital age, its channels are actually struggling. Alex, on Sunday night recently, ITV was beaten, well, in fact, on all of Sunday, from morning to evening, they were beaten by Channel 4. They have a problem there. What should they do?
I think that partly that's not ITV, that's Channel 4 getting stronger and Channel 4's commissioning rounds being actually getting more of where the audience is going. So there is still a long way for Channel 4 to go, but it's getting it more and more and more. And for ITV, I think partly you need to push towards digital, but I'm always going to say that I have a huge bias, and because ITV Player, user experience wise, is just stop giving me adverts. I appreciate that.
You'll find it's called ITV Hub these days. Different product. Different.
It's the same thing.
It's not that different from All Four, though. The experience in All Four is similar when it comes to advertising. It's, you know, it's still three pre-rolls and then the content and then another five adverts.
I mean, it seems to me you talk about Channel 4 getting stronger, and they have, in fairness. Arguably, they've become more mainstream. But actually, isn't it, in a way, kind of about ITV slightly appealing to the wrong person? I mean, you think about who used to be the core ITV viewer 10 years ago. ITV now appeals much more to me, and that's probably a problem for them, isn't it?
Problem for you.
No, but I'm much more likely to watch Tom Bradby hosting the news at 10, or a documentary about Marguerite, or Michael Gambon playing Churchill. But those are all kind of Channel 4 shows from 10 years ago.
That just shows that you're getting old, I think.
I'm a middle class southerner, that's what I'm saying. You know, they're trying to broaden their palette, but they've actually sort of ended up, perhaps, I would argue, showing programmes that are actually more attuned to the people who are running it than the people who used to watch it.
I think you have a point, but I think that there is a massive opportunity on... Netflix are winning. Netflix are winning at the sort of content that... So the BBC term for it is the appeal to the replenisher audience. So the BBC buzz term of, okay, these people are growing away from our content. How do we get these younger or more digitally savvy or whatever that thing is into our... And that's the bit that ITV is missing. What is the new exciting thing? Downton Abbey was this glorious success, still is. But it's not a replenisher audience. It's not the new young things coming and finding that. It's the people we already know and the market we already have. It's how do you build upon that with this new... If ITV just jumped off and went, right, we're going to do this innovative programme. They tried it with the ITV Question Time. Is that still running or has that already vanished?
Well, The Agenda with Tom Bradby. Yeah, I like it. There you go. I'm exemplifying the issue.
That's not new. That's not exciting. It's well-produced, but still, it's not a new idea. It's not pushing boundaries. It's not Channel 4's the word. It's not anywhere near there, is it? Let's be honest.
If only Jeremy Corbyn was on the show this week, involved in any kind of version of some of the antics they used to get up to on The Word, licking out someone's belly button. Before we head to the break, you may have noticed that Radio 2's obsession with pop-up stations has intensified in the past few years, from Radio 2 Eurovision to the forthcoming Radio 2 Country, which I am very excited about. Yes, I am a closet country nerd. The station has been breaking out of its usual schedule to provide more to the tastes of selected groups of listeners. But how useful are these temporary channels, and is the BBC testing the ground for something bigger from Radio 2 in the future? The Media Podcast went to BBC Maida Vale Studios to find out.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Sam Hunt. I'm excited to let y'all know we will be coming back to C2C this year. Hope y'all can make it out. We'll see y'all soon.
Hello, my name's Al Booth, and I'm the specialist music editor for Radio 2 and 6 Music.
I'm Brett Spencer. I'm editor for the digital output for all of the BBC's popular music radio networks. I think the first one was Five Lives Olympics Sports Extra, and that was really about being able to provide a lot more coverage of the Olympics that Five Live couldn't provide just on their own station and on Sports Extra. The first one we did at Radio 2 was Radio 2 Eurovision, and that was really because we wanted to sort of try and reinvent the way we covered Eurovision and to provide a much richer experience from Eurovision fans over several days of what the contest was about. But it's also really crucially for us about getting Radio 2 listeners to listen on digital platforms. So about 54% of our listeners currently listen digitally at some point during the week, but we want to continue to move that on and get them to consume us in different ways, either on DAB or online, as opposed to just listening on FM.
Okay, so let's talk about Radio 2 Country then. Last year was the first year that you did that, and it's coming back again. It's all built around Country to Country, which is this huge country music festival at the O2. Partnering with such an obviously commercial entity must have had its own challenges right from the beginning.
Well, Country to Country has been running for 3 years as a festival, and from day one, Radio 2, this was before Radio 2 Country last year, but Radio 2 was the broadcast partner. We do it quite a lot with quite a lot of festivals. We were the broadcast partner for Blues Fest recently. We've been the broadcast partner for Cambridge Folk Festival. So what makes this kind of more unique is that obviously Radio 2 is the only national station that does do country music. So in that way, it makes absolute editorial sense that we would be reflecting the biggest country festival that there is in the UK on Radio 2, because it just is where people would expect it.
And bear in mind, in previous years, we had broadcast highlights of the festival on Radio 2. So actually, by broadcasting all of it, we're getting much better value for money for licence fee payers from the money that we're spending on broadcasting that event. So actually, we're getting a much better deal out of it.
Now, how many of the Radio 2 lineup are country fans? Because obviously, you've got Bob Harris, who's the face of country on Radio 2. But I imagine it's a bit like Five Live, and not everyone there likes football. I mean, in the same way, are you having to crowbar some presenters from Radio 2 and say, you're going to present a show all about Dolly Parton, or are there enough country fans?
Do you know what?
There?
It's really interesting because, ostensibly, no, there aren't that many country fans. But once you actually start talking to the Radio 2 mainstream guys, you realise that they do. They say, oh, well, I don't really know much about country music, but I do like Dolly Parton, and I do like the Eagles, and I do like Mary Chapin Carpenter. And suddenly you're saying, well, actually, what you're saying is you like quite a lot of country music. So there's always an access point. You know, it's been great because we're in the middle of recording some of the shows now, and I actually was in the studio yesterday with Jeremy Vine recording his Jeremy Vine Stomping Country, which I thought, right, Jeremy's just done Strictly. He likes a bit of country music. He turned up at C2C last year. He loves Casey Musgraves. And I thought, right, I'll ask him if he'll do a kind of dance crazes in country music.
And as we said before, it's all about providing more Radio 2. So if you listen throughout the 4 days we're on air, you'll hear those presenters pointing towards Radio 2 Country as a choice of listening at the top of hour. And that's the only time that really happens on Radio 2. So Jeremy will say, at 1 o'clock, you can hear me, another hour of me on Radio 2, or we'll point to an alternative programme on Radio 2 Country. And having all the presenters involved obviously helps us with that, because then they have an investment and they're really involved in the content of the station.
What are the logistical challenges of setting up a live radio station as a pop-up at an event? You know, you're not even in your own studios. And what have you learned from last year that you're going to try and iron out this year?
We get a great room at the O2 that they give us, which is the fancy, it's called the Fab Room. And it's basically where all the kind of VIPs that would be at the O2 would hang out, and it's a really excellent room, and we get that backstage. So it's what we can do is it's large enough to bring in a full DJ set up. Usually got two presenters there. We've got space for a band to come in to do some live music. There's a little room at the back where the interactive guys that are doing the live blog and all the social media stuff, that they're all there as well. It's the same as doing an outside broadcast really for Radio 2 itself, because you just set up a working studio, and then there's a studio back at Western House that is set up as the Radio 2 Country studio, and they're taking all the outside sources and all of that kind of stuff. So it is like there is a little studio on the fourth floor of Western House that becomes Radio 2 Country for 4 days, and everything comes out of that.
Okay, you're both doing far too good a job at publicising the station. What went wrong last year? Looking back on it, what didn't work?
I wouldn't say something went wrong, but I think what had the potential to go wrong, and Al can speak about this better than me, is explaining to people from the US and from Nashville what we're doing and why we're doing it. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, as soon as you start trying to explain to a manager of a big country act in Nashville about a pop-up digital station, don't understand pop-up, don't understand what a digital station is, Americans usually. They're like, well, what is that? Is that online? It's like, well, it is online, but it's a bit more than that. And so trying to explain that, and trying to explain that it is part of Radio 2, but it's not actually Radio 2. And so that was quite difficult. So we did have situations where we'd gone through the whole process and we got all the contracts sorted, and then we get to the O2 and the guys on stage are like, we don't know anything about this. What is this? No, we don't really want you to take us live. And then you're like, okay, this is the whole point of today. And so then you're having to get into some discussions. But that's really about awareness with the Americans and with the record companies out of Nashville. And this year is already loads better because we did it last year. And they suddenly saw, I mean, the artists saw like huge, massive ramp-ups of sales. People that were playing over the weekend after we did Radio 2 Country, you could really, yeah, we shifted some records for them. So yeah. I think suddenly people understand it.
Okay, so Radio 1 has Radio 1 Extra, Radio 4 has Radio 4 Extra, Radio 2 has Radio 2 Country and Radio 2 Eurovision, and it seems to me like inside all of these pop-up stations there's a Radio 2 Extra struggling to get out, but it can't, because you know commercial radio would kick up such a fuss if you actually proposed such a thing.
I don't think it's that at all, actually, because what you're talking about there is you're talking about starting a new radio station, and what we're talking about is providing more of what Radio 2 does on other platforms. We don't look on these as stations, as it were. We look on these as opportunities to provide much greater coverage of a Radio 2 property, for want of a better word, on other platforms, to provide a deeper experience of that event, and also to get people to listen on digital platforms.
But there's
which is
enough
not the same
archive.
As starting up a station.
But there's enough archive, isn't there? Friday Night is Music Night going back 50 years or whatever. There's enough archive to do a Radio 2 Extra that the Radio 2 audience would love. You know, if there's enough people listening to Bob Harris for 2 hours a week that want to listen to 3 days worth of it, then obviously every single show you do could do the same thing, no? Silence has descended. It doesn't get discussed? Secretly, you'd like to do a Radio 2 Extra.
It's not been discussed.
Okay. Good luck. What are the highlights?
Well, I would say Jeremy Vine's Stomping Country, having recorded it yesterday, that's certainly going to be worth a listen. But the highlight is being down there at the O2 and seeing these enormous stars from Nashville one after another across the weekend, you know, performing to 30,000 people. That's pretty amazing. And when we put that out on air, that is, you know, that feels to me like incredible that we have the opportunity to do that and to bring such contemporary, massive country music to such a wide audience.
And we're excited this year to have a Radio 2 Country stage at the O2 as well. Because one of the things we felt last year is that we didn't really have much brand awareness, if you like, for people who are actually at the event. So this year we'll have our own stage with live acts playing and talks and that sort of thing.
Enjoy.
Thank you very much. Please join us March the 10th at midday.
Shall we see what's on the Media Podcast Jukebox today? Ah, delightful. Now, as I'm sure you've noticed, it's about this time every year when all the various media festivals release their early bird tickets. And with so many events to choose from, like Sheffield Dockfest, Radio Days Europe, MIPCOM, the Edinburgh TV Festival, it's good to plan ahead. So praise be then for your donations, because without them, we wouldn't be able to leave these four walls to bring you our unparalleled coverage. Here on the Media Podcast, not only do we make special editions from those festivals, we carefully select the finest sessions as bonus episodes for you to enjoy in the most convenient way. Because let's face it, if you can't be there in person, audio is the best. Who spends 45 minutes on YouTube? Even for Armando Iannucci. All this is only possible because of your support, because with the stability you can give us, we can plan the shows of the future. You can continue to help us cover these festivals for significantly less than it takes to attend. Just bung us a few quid a month and we'll bring the highlights to you on this podcast. You don't even have to wear a stupid lanyard. Go to themediapodcast.com now and click on donate. Just a fiver a month will take us to Edinburgh, to Sheffield, to Paris, and a tenner might just get us back. Themediapodcast.com. It just takes 1 minute. Do it now. Thanks.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, let's tackle some of the other stories of the week. And Dame Janet Smith's review into allegations against Jimmy Savile at the BBC made for some eye-catching headlines. Serious failings, whitewash, the BBC Trust must be scrapped, they're just a few. But now that it's all settled down, what have you made of her report for us?
I haven't read the report because I hear it's huge. I hear it's a monster of a... So it's something crazy, like 300,000 words or something insane like that.
But it may not have been a full public inquiry, but they went for it as if it were.
It's like Encyclopedia Britannica. But, I think the thing that is... I don't know if it's encouraging is the right word to use, but it just feels old in the sense that it doesn't feel like it's something that could happen today. And I just hope that that's true. I hope that everything that's been said and everything that's happened in that space is something that we're so shocked and appalled about it because... it's something that we would never allow to happen now. And I just hope that's true. I mean, that's all you can hope for now. Because I think that I would expect anybody from any level that sees any sort of abuse like that to report it immediately. And I actually think that what's happened with recent cases, and obviously I won't mention any names, but it does seem that there have been people that have been indicted or have been caught up in this, in acting inappropriately to different levels of members of staff, and they are being reprimanded as a result of that. And some of those people are in prison, some of those people are being investigated, and I think that that's been the kind of positive outcome of this, is that people feel like they can come forward and something will be done about it.
But it was wrong to not report it if you knew anything then, and the purpose of the report was to see whether anyone knew anything. And Alex, according to this report that has cost millions, no one at the BBC, no one who worked on Children in Need, no one who worked on Jim'll Fix It, no one knew anything.
Which, you read all the press lines about just how much of an open secret it was, or how many people had inklings of something, and then when does an inkling become something you report, and when does something you should report become actually harmful to your career? That's the thing. And so Lord Hall was up on stage for quite a while, way longer than I thought he would be up, during that full morning of being discussed. And he was very much saying that everyone should feel like they should come forward and report all these things. And still there's a culture of, you do not become a snoop, you do not become a grass, because who hires you after you've told other people? And it's horrible, and that shouldn't happen, but it still does. Talent is still called talent, and there's a step aside from the people who aren't front of screen or aren't front of house. And trying to break down those bridges is a key part of what the BBC and any broadcaster, any newspaper, any media outlet at all should be working towards. But the mentality of people who think they can get away with it still remains.
And there's very limited amounts that we can say about this, because legal proceedings are going to ensue. But the question is two words. Tony Blackburn.
I wouldn't even want to comment on that without knowing exactly what's going to come out of that, and what the allegations are, and what happens from there. What I would say...
Essentially, he's lost his job because his version of events didn't tally with the BBC's, though. Because they're not saying that he did anything. They're saying his version of events didn't tally with what we would have expected. Is that good enough?
I am keeping dead quiet.
we've all heard lawyers are involved.
I just want to really quickly make this point. So there is a suggestion in the report that the victims said that they didn't want it taken any further, and there is something that we have to be aware of about the respect of victims in this scenario. And if you are an exec producer and you're speaking to that person and they say to you, I'm being quite clear about this, I don't want to do anything with it, we do have to be quite aware of their wishes and how they want to handle it. I don't think it's simply just a case of, this person's a producer, an exec producer, and they did nothing with this information. I think there are lots more nuances in this, and as by the size of the report indicates, it's very complicated, and we've got to be a little bit careful about having one broad stroke to say they should have done this instead of doing that.
Okay, there is no easy segue from that story to the next, so I'll just go straight into it. Let's talk about the ratings for BBC Three. Two of its new series have made the top 10 online shows, as measured by the ratings body Barb. That's Cuckoo and Life and Death Row, which started new runs last week without a terrestrial broadcast. Is this good news for the controller of BBC Three, Damien Kavanagh? You would assume so, wouldn't you, for us, looking at these figures?
So, look, my feeling on this is, and I feel like this across the board when it comes to online content, you have to spend money on advertising what you're doing online. You have to kind of draw attention to it. I found it really curious that the amount of money that BBC has spent on traditional media, pushing them to online media, the amount of billboards that have been out there, newspaper articles, I found it absolutely hilarious that Greg from Cuckoo was on the one show launching BBC Three, what's meant to be a youth channel, online by cutting a fake digital ribbon, and then they kind of cut outside to them trying to break a selfie record with a blurry photo that was and they failed to break that record. In addition to that, I mean, it was, you know, they have made a lot of noise, they've put in a lot of investment to tell people that it's on BBC Three, and actually if they didn't get into the top 10 of the iPlayer, which is their own space, then I think that would have been a real disaster. That the question now is whether or not they can sustain that. It's important to note that, and the story came out recently about Clash of Clans, which is an iPhone game, and the amount of money that they've spent on advertising. It's something crazy, like, you know, £500 million has been spent on advertising that game on the App Store. Can the BBC sustain that level of investment when it comes to drawing attention to their content online? That's what I'm curious to see, particularly when they've cut money.
That's a really interesting point, and of course it doesn't cost the BBC anything to advertise on their own shows, does it? So, I mean, they don't have to sustain the amount of money, it's just whether it's a fair playing field, Alex.
And it becomes a lot fairer playing field than what we don't realise is, you know, we talked about the idea of there only being one channel, there only being two channels, then three, then four, then five, then Sky Start, and it was loads more channels. You've just opened yourself up to YouTube as a competitor. You've just opened yourself up to Netflix, Amazon Prime. And if Netflix can afford to spend $50 million a series, as they did do on House of Cards, the BBC cannot compete with that level of production. you know, that has the names and the writing and just the brilliance of that program. It brings people in. They're advertising it across the online. They're advertising it in very viral ways. Like you were saying, people use clever marketing tactics. So I've been privy to a couple of private briefings about how new things are marketed. They don't put it on TV. They don't put it on the One Show. They go to key YouTubers and key Instagrammers and work with them in content partnerships. And that's something, it's outside Radio 1 that the BBC hasn't been as quick on as its competitors.
But the BBC's not trying to compete with House of Cards on BBC 3, are they? They're trying to do public service programming for young people.
If they're trying to get 16 to 24-year-olds into programming, which, if you look at the average age of BBC 3, it hasn't done in the past, and so this move, we're still yet to get the demographics of this, but Netflix hits that, Instagram hits that, YouTube hits that square in the face. To move those people into this space, it is difficult, and I think without some genius innovations in how they touch it and how they innovate around it, it always felt like it wasn't fully thought through at the time. They didn't have, if you look at the amount of 22, 23 year old people, 24 year old people actually employed by the BBC, particularly in editorial or production roles, it shows. You know, what's the best way to reach 16 to 24 year old people? Hire 16 to 24 year old people to make or to push out or to advertise this content.
And I've said this a number of times, but I continue to mention it. The reality is that the BBC had a point of difference when it comes to younger audiences when they're competing with Amazon and Netflix and all of those people that you could not buy your way into, and that's that they had a TV channel. And now they don't have a TV channel, so they are the same as all of those other competitors, and they are going to have to figure out how they're going to be able to be more noisy and be able to cut through to that audience when they are competing with other things that are on your phone screen or on your computer screen. They didn't have to do that when they had a TV channel.
Okay, whilst we're talking about Amazon and Netflix, that moves seamlessly onto Top Gear. Because there is some suspicion that Netflix will be picking up the BBC's new Top Gear. Obviously, they'll show it first run on BBC Two, but then perhaps 6 months later it will be available to stream in the UK, and perhaps it'll even go out simultaneously in the States and places like that on Netflix. And of course, that will go against Amazon's new big Clarkson show. Alex, this has actually got bigger now than Clarkson versus the BBC. This has become Netflix versus Amazon.
And that is where it becomes fascinating. So we talked earlier about ITV's model of how they're syndicating programmes. Because of the unique way the BBC is funded, they don't have enough money to sustain themselves by not selling to all sorts of people for all sorts of incredible prices. Doctor Who works because it's so fancy and it's so well sold overseas. And Top Gear is in that exact category. And I still think Clarkson will win. I really do, because it feels... Did you ever watch The Big Breakfast?
Yes.
When Johnny Vaughan and Denise Van Outen left, can you remember the next presenter?
That's a great question. Was it Richard Bacon?
Chris O'Connell, I think.
It was probably Rufus Hound. It's always Rufus Hound. Anyway, I take your point.
And therein lies my point. So once you've taken out like Clarkson, and well, those three, but mainly Clarkson, were that show.
You've now made me think that Chris Evans should have brought along Gabby Roslin and Zig and Zag as his Top Gear co-presenters.
That I would have watched. And so you're thinking it's like that in reverse, because you know Chris Evans is obviously the part of the Big Breakfast star. But once you remove the defining characteristics of a programme and it just becomes a programme about cars with people who might be as funny, who might be as engaging, who might be as challenging as Clarkson et al., you are risking a huge amount for the sake of a brand.
But actually, doesn't this conversation in a way misunderstand the fact that on the internet, although it's fun to talk about Amazon versus Netflix, actually viewers get to see both? I mean, if you're interested in cars and you're interested in humour, you like Clarkson and you like Chris Evans, you can see both. You don't see them as competitors. You watch both. You watch one after the other.
But then that goes from $7.99 or, you know, what, $9.99 a month for Netflix plus Amazon's, although it's cheaper for the moment. I can't imagine that's going to stay for longer. Plus your license fee, when does the spending stop? And if you look at the way that people look at news sites, people only look at one news site a day. People could only subscribe to one or two things. Do they pick Amazon and Netflix, or do they pick Netflix and something else, or Amazon and something else? Because it's so new, we don't know what the audience data will show about just how many things people subscribe to. It's the great unknown, and my guess is that Netflix have got it right. Amazon are adding it as an extra and taking the sort of BT model of have our TV for free if you sign up for some other things. We just have no idea.
So that's a question, isn't it?
Producer Matt has just passed me an iPhone Wikipedia page, and apparently Paul Tonkinson and Donna Eyre took over from Chris and Gavi, from Johnny and Denise.
But you know, it's curious because there's a conversation about, well, who's going to win when it comes to Top Gear or Richard Hammond, Clarkson, and May shows is going to be. But if you talk about Netflix versus Amazon, everybody goes, well, obviously Netflix are going to win. If you talk about Clarkson versus Chris Evans, well, obviously, I mean, there's obviously a clear strategy from Amazon to try and get that mind share, and they'll use this show as well as they've used Highcastle and Mr. Robot to kind of push it in that and get credibility in that space as well. But I think that this story, you know, I would be kind of surprised if Netflix didn't pick up the secondary rights to Top Gear. I mean, it was always going to happen. The brand is still called Top Gear. It's, you know, it's coming up 6 months after, outside of the iPlayer window. It's what I expect to see on Netflix anyway, so I'm not particularly surprised about this particular story.
The good news for, we were talking in the last episode that Chris Evans was heading up to the upfronts, and that, you know, people from around the world were going to see whether they liked the clips that they saw. It appears BBC Worldwide have done a good enough job packaging that lots of companies around the world do want to buy it.
Yeah, but it's got Top Gear as a name. I mean,
Simple as that. You could put Zig and Zag presenting
exactly.
it. They'd still
I absolutely think that, particularly for the first series, the first series is going to be a curiosity. Everyone is going to tune in to see what the first episode of Top Gear is going to be like. Mm. I think that there's been a mix of reality and PR work going on about, you know, can Chris Evans drive a car and talk at the same time? I can almost guarantee that the first clip that you're going to see of Top Gear is Chris Evans driving a car and not saying anything, and there's a bit of a nod and a wink to the camera. That's what's going to happen, because that's part of the fun of Top Gear. That's what you see. They did it when there was a whole, you know, when Clarkson was there, and every time a news story broke where he did something a little bit naughty, they had a nod and a wink at a camera, and you would expect that sort of banter or humour to continue when they're going in with Chris Evans. And so that's what's going to happen, and I think the first season, people are going to watch it, they're going to tune in, and as is always the case with this sort of thing, we've got to see what happens halfway through the season and when it comes to recommission.
I mean, something that they probably won't be making a cheeky reference to is what Bob Mortimer, the comedian, tweeted out this week. He called Top Gear a time bomb. Most of the press covered that. Can you unpick that story for us? What was the gossip behind the scenes there?
It is a time bomb if you're going to be as, you know, be as obvious as that. I mean, you know, it's either going to work, the bomb is either going to explode, it's going to be amazing.
But the bomb was Chris Evans, and Bob Mortimer is close friends with Lisa Clark, who's the executive who left the production, according to the press, because she fell out with Chris Evans. What about his ego?
But then Clarkson was a time bomb, and I don't think anybody was surprised that it ended the way it was.
But that's the point, isn't it? Have they learnt anything?
I think that if you're going to create a show that is about personalities talking about high testosterone subjects like cars, then there's going to be a difficult scenario that ensues. And, you know, I still have yet to see anybody else come to the fore that could beat Chris Evans in this space as a personality to take on this mantle. So I think that everybody was going to want to see it. And you know what? If he's difficult and he's going to be a tricky person to follow, I would rather it was that way round rather than have kind of three unknown faces that were quite bland and you ended up getting quite a vanilla show a la what Top Gear was before the rebrand when Clarks came along in the first place.
Okay, the media quiz is along shortly. That's a bit of clickbait for you. But before we get there, let's talk about clickbait. If the BBC stopped publishing soft news stories online, soft news, the commercial sector, apparently, could grow by £8 million a year. That is according to a government-commissioned report. Alex, explain first of all what is meant by soft news, and then secondly, tell us whether you agree.
Soft news is so you move away from the big news. So we move away from the EU debate and certain bits of Trump's coverage around the US election. We move away from the migrant crisis in Calais. We move towards, I mean,
Amanda Shedd,
for example. Or we move towards sort of the cat pictures on the back of New Day. Or we move towards interesting things that you will talk about, but you won't have your mind changed about it because it's not serious news. And the BBC historically has not done enough of it. The BBC has, as a brand, the capacity and the audience to work through all of the nonsense on the internet, and same as what we're trying to do at Metro.co.uk, is distill that and curate it in a very reputable and truthful way. And I commissioned and petitioned and worked hard to make the BBC do more of it, because it's what the BBC should be doing. You, in the same way as its TV shows don't have to be either populist or incredibly niche. You can do both, and you should do both, and the BBC has to be where its audience are, or where its audience could be, or where its audience wants to be, and part of that is distilling the internet into a usable and readable or consumable form.
So they do a bit of it, don't they? I'm thinking here about, I think they call it BBC Magazine, don't they, online?
There's Magazine, which is actually an in-depth feature list. There's BBC Trending, which is a mixed media thing with a blog and a video outlet, and they appear on BBC World News a lot, BBC Terrestrial less so. And BBC Trending picks up trends without being too mean, because they have to, maybe 24 hours after they've been covered elsewhere. And they talk to the people involved in them, and they add value to them. So they're kind of providing a service of trending news for the people who don't follow trending news.
So that's the stuff the government says the BBC might consider stopping doing, and you're saying they're not doing enough of it.
The big proposal in the BBC charter was to bring more 16 to 24 year olds into this space, and you should not patronise and only offer soft news, but if you somehow exclude a big part of what they care about as their entry point to what the BBC news service offers, then you are, well, you, no, you are removing that entry point. So why would they visit you when they visit, when BuzzFeed is spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on big serious investigations, but your entry point to BuzzFeed is the 17 things that you didn't know about Romford, and then you happen to click on this earnest investigation in partnership with Newsnight that unearths some great conspiracy. It's the way the market works, so it can't be the way that the BBC, it can't be removed from the BBC.
Now, the Press Gazette also highlighted, and I quote, that the BBC's rival commercial radio stations could get a boost of up to £38 million a year if the corporation's music and sports radio services concentrated on lower profile sports and offered a broader range of music. I mean, yeah, Faraz, isn't that just a version of saying if BBC One was shit, more people would watch ITV? We know this.
I'd love it if they made that suggestion about television and they were starting to say that, oh, the World Cup shouldn't be on the BBC. I'd like to see what the outcry of that would be, where you would only be able to watch the World Cup or the Olympics on ITV. I imagine that there'll be a few people that are quite upset about that.
But in radio, they do suggest it, and the talk is, and these rumours were quashed, weren't they, but the talk is out there that Five Live was under consideration, that they might move Five Live online. What do you think of that?
I think that there's a curious thing that's happening in the industry, and I think that this is happening faster than television moving online. I think that radio moving online is happening at a much quicker speed, and I think we're seeing a lot of people listening to radio via internet-connected devices, be it their phone or be it a Sonos system or whatever it might be. There is a definite trend where people are taking their audio consumption. I mean, we're on a podcast, you know. People are taking their audio consumption now digitally, and actually there is an argument to say that we should be looking at the BBC providing more services in that space. But I imagine it would happen organically rather than happening, you know, via the sword of whoever these regulators are.
The BBC put out a statement pretty sharpish to deny, as I say, that they're thinking about moving Five Live online. But Alex, do you think that is feasible? The Independent has moved online, BBC Three has moved online. Is it feasible?
I think in the long term, yes. The second that car radios catch up to being digital only, absolutely, because you think, I can't remember the last time I listened to a radio when it was actually through an FM signal or even a DAB signal. The only people listening to radio are the people who are of an older generation or the people who are driving to work. So
that's a lot of people.
That's my point. So it is a lot of people for the moment, but you can see, I think, like you were saying, organically, it's just that people are growing into it, and it's easier to consume digital radio. You don't have to tune a dial, you don't have to push buttons, you just press go, and the iPlayer radio app is very, very good.
But for a news and sports station, you need to be just there, don't you, on tap for everyone. It's going to be 20 years before we get to the stage where everyone has access to getting the news in the way you're describing. Nothing could be easier than turning on an AM signal, however crackly it sounds.
Yeah, but I would argue that things can't get much easier than plugging in your phone to your car, and that's getting easier and easier. The amount of people that own a car and have their phone Bluetooth to their car or have it as a lining connection, people aren't reaching for their dial on their car radio. They're reaching to plug in their phone and listen to the audio that's coming out of there, and they may listen to live radio via TuneIn or via the iPlayer app, or they may be listening to their own music library on their phone. That's been happening for quite a long period of time
now.
It's
still 20 years away. I'm a podcast evangelist. It's still 20 years away.
What, are people turning off
their saying car nothing radios? Could be easier than listening to online audio in your car. That is 20 years away.
I've said that before.
The radio is easier.
I've said that before. I forget where I wrote it, but I was writing that there is no possible way that the FM signal needs to survive. And I got a number of really frustrated emails about people who live, once again, it's our London privilege. Few areas without 4G, nowhere is without 3G, except for my bedroom, which is still a black spot. But everywhere outside London, you don't have those receptions, and that's where you have a point. But still, you can have 10 years, you can't have 20.
Before we go, there is just time for our media quiz.
Oh, hooray!
This week it is entitled Life in Salford with David Attenborough. The celebrated zoologist and broadcaster hasn't been to Salford this week, but if he had, how would he describe the following stories connected to Media City UK? Let's find out through my, it says here in my script that I hadn't read yet, excellent impersonation. It's quickfire, so just buzzing with your name when you know the Salford story. So Alex, you will say...
Alex.
And Faraz, you will say...
Faraz.
The loser receives the complete box set of Don't Scare the Hare. The winner gets Mr. Bloom. Right, so this is my apparently excellent impression. Here comes Salford story number one. Buzz in when you know the answer, and please put me out of my misery. As the dominant male swims upstream, a plague descends on Key House. The vermin are insects of the order Blatodia, and they are looking more resilient than the plans for BBC Studios. But what's the story?
Faraz, is this about Peter Salmon leaving BBC Studios in the lurch by walking away?
Yes. Peter Salmon is leaving the BBC as The Guardian reports that cockroaches have moved into one of the buildings occupied by the corporation. So that was why we were doing the natural history thing. Salmon swam upstream, that was what that was. Right. Here is execrable impression number two.
It's dawn, and the pack are in mourning. Their elder has been taken from them 56 years after his coronation. His story is...
Yes, Alex.
There you go. The bloke who made Coronation Street has died.
Correct. Tony Warren, the creator of Coronation Street, has died at the age of 79. Calling him the bloke that created Coronation Street, I don't know if that gives you a half point. But for the sake of Jeopardy, I'll give you an equal point, and it's all
Tony
to play
Warren.
For. Tony Warren, yes. No longer with us. And worked on Corrie for, like, ages. Like, he created when he was 23 or something.
That's the thing to come out of those stories. He's just very much like... He was just a boy when he was first. Like, you're such a whippersnapper.
Yeah, extraordinary. Right, okay, here we are. Salford story number three. It's the tiebreaker.
It's dusk, and the lesser-spotted presenters that cover the night shift traverse the landscape like so many before. But their calls will not be heard in the Key tonight, for the predatory Salford City Council is near.
Faraz, this is about Salford City... being bastards and banning swearing.
That is fucking correct. The council have planned to curb swearing around Media City UK following complaints from residents. So if you're working in the area, including the comedian Mark Thomas, who's playing at the theatre up there soon, you're not supposed to swear.
I know, but then when does a swear begin and a curse end?
Buggered if I know. But that means Faraz is the winner today. Congratulations.
Hooray!
Well done. That is our show for today. My thanks to Faraz Osman and to Alex Hudson. Now, if you're thinking, I'm new to the media podcast, but I'm already thinking about how to fit it into my busy life on a regular basis, then the best way to do it is to subscribe. Go to themediapodcast.com and all the links that you need there for iTunes or Pocket Cast or Stitcher and other unpopular programs are there. Welcome aboard. Today's show is dedicated to Dr. Stuart Higgins, the producer of the podcast Scientists Not the Science, human stories from the science world. And he loves trying to score full marks on the media quiz whilst doing experiments in the lab. I hope my David Attenborough impression didn't just ruin that pleasure for you, Stuart. Plus, all the wonderful people who have felt moved by the sound of Nimrod to set up a regular contribution, ensuring our long-term survival. James Ball, Richard Walkington, Morris Giles, thank you, chaps. To join these swelling ranks and keep us on the air, just go to themediapodcast.com/dedicate. It takes 1 minute. Do it now. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer was Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. And until next time... Bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.